Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Jason Howell and I are back in the studio, and we have a really exciting episode planned because we get to talk to Apollo's developer. Yes, Apollo, the Reddit client on iOS. Christian Selig joins us to talk about where Reddit is right now, the Reddit blackout, and why Apollo may be closing down on June 30th. Then we talk to Nicola Aegis of Search Engine Land about Google's ad business and the challenges coming out of the EU. Will there be a future for Google ads in the EU? I don't know. And of course, our stories of the week. Christina Warren had a great piece over on Inverse about Apple getting into gaming in a new way. And we talk about Sir Paul McCartney's choice to use AI to release a new Beatles track. The Beatles nerd, Jason Howell, has all of that. Of course, an AI nerd as well to talk about. So stay tuned for this episode of Tech News Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 290, recorded Thursday, June 15th, 2023.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by the AWS Insiders Podcast. Search for AWS Insiders in your podcast player or visit cloudfix.oria.com/podcast. We'll also include a link in the show notes. My thanks to AWS Insiders for their support.
And by Brooklinen. This year, give your dad the gift of a good night's sleep. They deserve the best rest, and Brooklinen has their comfort covered with a lineup of home essentials made for relaxation. Visit brooklinen.com today and get $20 off plus free shipping on orders of $100 or more with code TNW.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. We are back in the studio this week. I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
And I'm the other one, Jason Howell. It's good to see you, Micah, in the flesh, in person.
We're back.
Good to see you. I'm excited for today because when I saw who our first guest was going to be, I was like, this is going to be fun.
Yes. So many of you probably know that Reddit is going through a bit of
a kerfuffle.
Yeah. I was going to say war at the moment. It's at the very least a kerfuffle.
Yeah, sure.
And
I just like calling things kerfuffles.
That's a really nice word. Don't mind me. Right? Yeah. So while we ponder whether it's a kerfuffle or a war or something in between, joining us is someone who I think can provide some more insider understanding of this because whether he chose to or not, he's ended up kind of at the forefront of what's going on at Reddit. It is the developer of Apollo, the Reddit client on iOS, Christian Selig. Welcome to the show, Christian.
Thanks so much for having me, you two. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Great to get to talk to you about this. As a person who has used Apollo for some time, has talked about it on my shows, seeing the tweet fly by where you mentioned that there were going to be some changes taking place, some unfortunate changes, that was definitely a pretty shocking moment, a pretty sad moment. And I'm glad to get to talk to you about this as we inch ever closer to the day where things change. But before we get into that, I always like to start out by making sure that we are all on the same page. So I was hoping that you could tell our listeners what an API is. We need to get this vocabulary in place and then how your app Apollo interacts with Reddit's API specifically.
Yeah. So if it helps, I think for like the first few years of being a programmer, the concept, like the word API, I still had no idea what it meant, but it's actually, it's incredibly simple. And I think that's why it is a little confusing because it's deceptively simple. It's just a way of talking to something, basically. So it's how you interact with something. So Reddit has an API that allows developers to talk to Reddit as a service and say, hey, could you upvote this comment for me? Or could you reply to this comment for me? Or could you give me the post in this subreddit? Or could you give me the comments for this specific post? And each of those is just an API request. So couldn't be simpler. Like Apple has APIs all over their operating system for doing certain things. Like if you were an app and you wanted to work with a Siri API, so Siri would be able to accept commands to your app through voice. Like it's just how you interact with something. And Reddit's historically, throughout its entire life of, gosh, almost 15 years, has had an API that lets developers communicate with Reddit and get data back and ask it to do things. So at a very high level, it's incredibly simple. You're just talking with Reddit and hopefully Reddit responds with helpful information.
Got it. Yeah. That's a great way to understand it. And you really nailed it in terms of it being a lot simpler than what you expect. And so whenever you hear it, you're like, is that all? Yeah. But that was a great way to put it. So that API, the Reddit API, is at the center of this Reddit controversy. Tell us about the upcoming change and how that's impacted your ability to continue offering Apollo, the very popular client on iOS.
Yeah. So, like I said, historically, Reddit's had that API and it's been free. So every time you requested information, you would basically hand Reddit a little token saying like, hey, I'm Apollo. I'm the one asking for this. Like, this information would be handy to have. And Reddit would provide it to developers. And there was kind of like a mutual understanding. Well, first off, like for a long time, Reddit didn't have any official app. So if you wanted to browse Reddit on mobile, it was through these third-party applications. But even once Reddit released it, there was still this kind of understanding. Their CEO even said at the time, like we want Redditors, people who use Reddit, to be able to browse Reddit through how they prefer. And if there's a different experience that maybe suits them better, we like giving people the option to browse Reddit in that way. Because say you go to Reddit and you download the official app and it just doesn't click for whatever reason. It's kind of better for everyone if rather than just ditching the service altogether, maybe there's a different way to browse Reddit that might strike a chord with you. And even beyond that, there's like less preferential reasons that it's nice to have. Like Reddit is staffed by an absolutely massive team of like unpaid volunteer moderators who moderate the communities and make sure that like spam is kept out, people are respectful, et cetera. And a lot of them prefer to do such a thing in third-party apps because the moderator tools are just a little bit more fleshed out, or they just find them faster or easier to use, or there's features that might not be available in the first-party app. And you also have like accessible users, someone who might be blind or low vision, who maybe the first-party app isn't very well labeled in terms of like screen reader support, so they'll prefer a third-party app. So there's a whole host of reasons why third-party apps have been like a huge part of Reddit's culture. And what's changing quite rapidly is that they're moving to a paid API, which is like, to be 100% clear, totally fair. Like, it's one of those things where Reddit came to developers and said, like, look, like, we like working with you and we don't want to kill you, but like, this, giving all of this, information away for free, isn't something we see as like tenable long term. And like, every developer I talked to was like, yeah, that makes sense. Like, I think it's benefited both parties, historically, but if that's something that you think, you would like money for, like, that's totally reasonable. We were, if anything, excited about it, because like there's been historically been some specific functions on Reddit that weren't exposed through the API. So being like, oh, we might be able to enter in a partnership with them in a little bit more of a formal capacity, mm-hmm. and maybe get access to more of those APIs. It was an exciting opportunity to maybe like formalize our relationship with Reddit a little better. But it's one of those things, like I said before, it's kind of the devil's in the details, where the price they ultimately landed on and the 30 days they gave from when the pricing was announced to when developers would start incurring potentially massive charges was only 30 days. So you kind of have these two really tricky aspects hitting you both at once as a developer, where the API has been available for 15 years and then you have 30 days to completely revamp your app. Otherwise you'll face like incredibly, like to the tune of millions of dollars in charges. So it just became very tricky for developers like myself, for Apollo, to figure out like how to survive that. And spoiler alert, you kind of can't.
Yeah. I almost imagine it, leading up to this point, there was a sort of a pedestal upon which was a red phone, and Apollo could always pick up the phone and talk to Reddit and get in touch with Reddit and get the data that it needed and then hang up, and then you would go about your way. Then suddenly they're saying, we're going to replace that red phone with a pay phone, which we haven't had for years. And now you're suddenly having to stick quarters into it in order to call up Reddit and get that data that you're trying to get. And there was a part of you that was excited because those quarters you were putting in meant that it would change from just like a standard payphone to also having a computer terminal in front of it where you could get more information than you ever could before, interact in all of these different ways. But instead, it sounds like they're asking you to put gold bricks into it instead of just quarters, where you would hope that it could just be the quarters to help it.
I appreciate how close you stuck to that analogy.
Thank you. Anyways. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. And the only thing I'd build on that analogy would be that, like, there was kind of a sign out front of the phone booth that said, "Hey, we're going to be doing this. It's not going to be free anymore, but we just want you to know that it's our interest isn't to like kill you, or we want this to be like a price that's based in reality and fair and equitable." Mm-hmm. And then you see in a gold bar, and you're kind of like, "I don't see how that is a cost representative,
right?
Like, thing based in reality." And then they're also like, "Also, you have 30 days to start giving us gold bars." And so it's like all those things kind of come together to be like, if you weren't trying to kill third party apps, like, how else did you think this would go? I guess would almost be my question. Like, it might just be they're quite removed. Like, Reddit's like they're worth billions of dollars. And it's kind of like, I don't know if they thought that's something that everybody has access to in terms of like millions of dollars, but I'm just building Apollo in my apartment and I certainly don't have that kind of money. So yeah, it became pretty untenable.
I think that's what's so surprising about how this is all played out. Cause like you said earlier, and I agree, like, Reddit is a company. It's here to make money. It's its own service. It can make the choices that it wants. Yet it 100%. Really seemed to set the stage early on that it was going to do something to allow third party developers like yourself to continue. It kind of put this cloud of hope in front of this thing and said, "Hey, don't worry about it. We're going to come up with something that's going to allow this to continue because it's really important to us." And yet, out the other side of their mouth, like, when it actually comes out, like, it really does seem like two opposite realities. Like, have you heard, or are you willing to address whether you've heard or not, anything from Reddit in kind of talking about that kind of bait and switch, but that about face between those two realities?
No, not really. I wish I could say I had an explanation, but like, I've asked them like kind of how they came upon these figures, because they said like these figures seem reasonable to them. And I was kind of saying, like, in one of my posts, I kind of broke down that they've historically posted, like, years ago, I think it was either 2019 or 2021. I'd have to look it up, but it was like, "Here's how much money we've made per quarter." It was like $100 million in their best quarter, and they have X many millions of monthly active users. So it was like 430 million. So you can do some very easy math there to say, like, okay, so this is your average revenue per month per user. So if you have like 430 million users and you have $500 million in revenue, that's, you know, napkin math. That's about $1 a year per user. And it works out to be about like 12 cents a month. So when you're saying like, "We're making 12 cents a month per user, but we think it's reasonable to charge you anywhere from like $1.50 to like $10 a user, depending on how much they use the app." That's like, you're looking at a multiple of like anywhere from 10 times to almost 100 times what they're earning per user. Like, it's just kind of like, they weren't ever able to answer how that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure it can.
Yeah, it kind of doesn't, right?
Yeah, it just doesn't. Yeah, yeah. I think that was almost why they couldn't explain it. And even beyond like the financials of revenue, I think Reddit's in a very unique position versus a lot of even other social media sites where you have like the Twitters and Facebooks of the world, where they, their moderators for the content they have are paid employees. Like, I think Facebook they have like something like a $200 million contract for 2 years with a company to do their moderation, where Reddit is like completely, it's unpaid volunteer moderators doing this just because they enjoy the communities. And I think it's very easy to say like Reddit has, bills to pay and engineers to pay, and they have to keep the lights on, like 100% absolutely. But it's also like, I think it's important to remember how much free labor they have that benefits the website. Mm-hmm. And not doing them a disservice by cutting off tools that they use to do their job. And just even the community at large, like Reddit doesn't sell any hardware or software themselves. Like, their value is intrinsically in the community and the content they create. So I think balancing this act of being like, are we respecting our community and moderators through our actions, is really integral, like, fundamentally to the financials of the company as well. And it's one of those things that it kind of feels like they're losing sight of, even though historically they've been quite good at balancing that.
Now, we don't have too much time, but I've still got a lot of questions. I do really want to ask you this, and you touched on it a little bit. I know you've probably gotten this question a lot. In fact, I've seen people ask you this question before. You published a post in which you announced you'd be shutting down Apollo just right before Reddit's new API policy goes into effect. And the question is, what made you choose to shut down the app, or what is going to make you choose to shut down the app instead of, say, raising the price for the Apollo subscription or asking folks to, you know, throw money into a tip jar for, you know, to sort of get you over the hump? Why, what's the choice to kind of shut down instead of go forth? And I want to preface this, or I guess postface this, by saying that the answers that I've seen you give really have made a lot of sense. And so I just want you to be able to communicate that to our listeners.
Yeah, honestly, there's so many reasons. And I think, I guess in the interest of time, I'll just say three. So the first one is, it doesn't seem to me like at this point, through the actions Reddit have taken, have indicated that they want third-party apps around in any capacity anymore. So it would be one of those things where, like, if you're going into work every day knowing your boss kind of hates you and is trying to figure out a way to get rid of you, it's not an environment that is super productive to work in, I would say. And I think, like, Reddit's actions, even through how they've kind of indirectly tried to kill third party apps, but even beyond that, like, there's been weird allegations where they said, I've like tried to blackmail them and stuff, which thankfully I recorded the call and said, showed there that wasn't the case at all. So there's like kind of just this bad blood aspect where they really seem to hate third party apps for some reason. I guess that would be reason one. Reason two would be, even just like, okay, just charge everyone $5 a month if they want to stay around. Like, the economics of that are really tricky because the way Reddit chose to do this is based on a per API call basis, which isn't inherently weird or anything, but at the price they chose, it changes the calculus a little. So, like, unsurprisingly, like, a free user typically uses less API calls than a paid user, so they cost less. The average subscription user in Apollo currently uses about a little less than 500 requests per day on average. So when you do the math, that works out to about, over the course of a month, it would cost about $3.60 or $3.70 to keep them around. So if I charge them $5, after Apple takes their cut, you're looking at like $3.50 left to the developer. So I'm at like 10, 20 cents in the red, on your average user. So then it's like, okay, so maybe you charge a little bit more, but then it's like, I also have a subset of users, like 5%, which is like tens of thousands of users who use between like 1,000 and 2,000 requests a day. So you're looking at that point, like between like $7.50 in fees and $15 in fees. And it just gets so exponentially expensive almost that it becomes almost, you've got to like choose like a phone plan where you try to estimate how much usage you're using. And then you have to turn off their service after a while. So it becomes very untenable, even from a financial aspect. Even if the price was cheaper, the third reason would be that I already have like around like 50,000 yearly subscribers who paid, like, say, Micah, you could have paid like 3 months ago, so you would still have like 9 months of your 12 months of service left. And I already collected your payment based on the operating costs I had at the time. So, like, design fees, server fees, I have a part-time server engineer, and about the dollar a month I charged you was able to cover that. Now Reddit's coming in and saying, like, starting July 1st, you're going to start incurring charges, where each of those users at absolute minimum, but more on average, $3.50 will cost about a dollar. So you have 50,000 users who have already paid and I can't monetize through no fault of their own, to be clear, that are going to start incurring between $1 and say $3 each. So I'm looking at a bill of like $50,000 to $150,000 a month, that'll start incurring July 1st. That I can't make any further money off of them. That'll just be like potentially hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of dollars I'll have to pay over the course of the year until their subscription expires. So like the calculus there is, it's just cheaper to work with Apple to refund all those subscriptions and close up shop than to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to Reddit. So there's like so many aspects where just the way they went about this, kill the third party apps in so many ways. I wish there was a way I could figure it out, but I talked with a lot of smart people. I was at DubDub last week, and just no matter who I talked to and how I tried to ring it out, it was just wasn't making any sense. There was always like a hiccup. And I tried to talk to Reddit and say, like, could you give us more time to make this change? And there was just radio silence on their end. They haven't answered my emails in a while. So,
yeah. And that's one thing that I think is well worth pointing out is the fact that it's not as if you got this news and then you just said, well, this isn't going to work and we're done with it.
No.
You and other third party developers have communicated with Reddit, have tried to reach some sort of agreement where instead of gold bars, it's silver bars or something. Going back to the original metaphor. But I want to ask you, one last question. I wish we could have you stick around for a lot longer, but I'm curious, do you think there's any chance that these ongoing blackouts, because there are some subreddits who've announced that they're going to continue things past this point, the outcry and even the press attention that you and others are getting, do you think that any of that could result in a change on Reddit's end, or are you pretty much certain, or not Reddit's end, but Apollo's end, or are you pretty much certain that come June 30th, I believe, you are going to sort of flip that big switch?
I would say I really hope it'll have an effect, because like I said, the changes that they would have to do to show the community that they are listening are so minor. It would just be a matter of, like, even if you just kept the same price, just saying, like, I will give you 90 days to try to come up with some gold bars and completely revamp your app, or... And ideally saying, like, look, we apologize for how we handled this, and we treated developers with a lot of, honestly, disrespect. And we're kind of going back to the drawing board, and we want to talk with them and figure out how we can make this right going forward. I think those steps are so minor and so easy to do that I would hope that they would respect the community enough to just do those minor things. But it's honestly, it's really anyone's guess at this point. I have no clue.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking some time today to talk to us. Christian Selig, if folks want to follow you online and see perhaps what's next, where should they go to do that?
I am on Twitter and Mastodon as at Christian Selig.
All right. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
The pleasure's all mine. Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, the EU has set its sights on Google's ad business. But first, let's take a quick break so I can tell you about AWS Insiders podcast, who are bringing you this episode of Tech News Weekly. AWS Insiders, it's a fast-paced, entertaining, and insightful look behind the scenes of AWS and cloud computing. And look, this is not your typical talking heads tech podcast. It's high production value, high energy, and high entertainment. It's full of captivating stories from the early days of AWS to today and beyond. Hosts Rahul Subramaniam and Hillary Doyle dig into the current state and the future of AWS by talking with the people and companies that know it best. Rahul is a veteran AWS pro with more than 15 years of experience managing more than 45,000 AWS instances. He's known for pushing AWS products to their limits and for believing AWS is truly the operating system of the future. AWS Insiders is a show that's full of opinions, takeaways, and untold stories about the challenges, innovations, and mind-blowing promise of cloud computing. I really liked an episode of AWS Insiders called Moderna, mRNA, and AWS, because the hosts, Rahul and Hillary, talked to Moderna's Director of Data Engineering and Cloud Architecture about how Moderna depends on AWS in the cloud. And you find out that Moderna was a cloud first company that they started there in thinking about how to take medicine and how to take health to the next level. It required that cloud computing aspect. So it's a fascinating sort of combination of medical technology, engineering, and cloud computing all wrapped up in one package. Very good stuff. You should search for AWS Insiders in your podcast player or visit cloudfix.aurea.com/podcast. That's cloudfix.aurea.com/podcast. Of course, we'll also include a link in the show notes. Our thanks to AWS Insiders for their support. All right, we are back from the break, and that means it's time for Jason Howell to take it away.
So it is not yet the end of the road for Google's ad business in the EU, but it certainly could be. We could be at the beginning of a very big transition here. The European Commission issued a formal antitrust complaint against the company this week. That places a target solely on Google's ad business. Certainly not the first time that we've heard of this being a possibility, but now it seems like we're you know, preparing to walk down this road, thanks to the EU. They called it anti-competitive with major implications if Google is found guilty. So we're going to dive into this. Joining me to pick this apart is Nicola Agius from Search Engine Land. It's great to have you on the show today. Thank you.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Thanks for taking the time. We should probably start by detailing what the EU had to share from its perspective about Google and its ad business, which is just so interesting, like where we are right now with this, before you kind of break this apart, because I mean, Google's been doing its ad business forever. So we're kind of like, we're so used to the way these things are operating, and it's so critical to Google's business. So tell us a little bit about what the EU has set out here.
Yeah, so unfortunately, yesterday wasn't the best day for Google.
No.
The European Commission started this investigation about 2 years ago, and it launched it to determine whether Google has been violating antitrust laws here in the EU. And yesterday, after a lengthy investigation, it announced that it was charging Google with violating these antitrust laws, and it released a statement of objections in response. And in this statement, it said that Google has been abusing its position as the world's dominant digital advertising platform. And basically what this means is Google, as we all know, operates in both the ad buying and ad selling space. And when the EU Commission did its report, did its investigation, it found that it was giving preference to ads placed with its own ad exchange platform called AdX. And according to the commission, this has been going on since at least 2014. And if this is all confirmed, this is actually an illegal practice by Google.
Wow. Which I guess what comes to me right now is, why now and not before? If this has been happening for so long, is it just that the temperature around, especially in the EU, the temperature in the EU seems very hot as far as, you know, putting that kind of target on big tech and really scrutinizing exactly how business is run? But I mean, Google's been doing this for a very long time, I imagine. Why now?
Well, that's what Google has said back in its statement. They released a statement yesterday in response, denying the charges. And in the statement, they also said that none of its operations are new. So I imagine Google's taken issue with that too.
Yeah, no question. So what kind of recourse does Google have to push back on this, at least at this stage? Because this isn't necessarily... Google's not proven to be guilty, let's say. This is kind of like setting the stage and saying, we believe this, but it still has a ways to go. At this stage, does Google have any recourse in kind of pushing back against this?
Well, Google, as I said, released a statement yesterday. Dan Taylor, Google Ads Vice President, said that, you know, none of these things are new. And he's also said that it relates to a very small part of its advertising business. Mm. So I imagine that's going to be one part of their argument. Also, I noticed in his statement that he spoke a lot about the EU Commission failing to recognize all the good that Google's been doing, such as lowering costs for consumers, increasing choices. So I should imagine that's going to form part of its argument. Also, this isn't the first time a case like this has been brought up against Google. I mean, I think it was just in January, the US Justice Department filed a very similar case. So it seems like Google's dealing with these accusations left, right, and center at the minute.
Yeah, right. At some point, you know, they'll be well rehearsed and well practiced on how to deal with this going forward. But what is your take on how this plays out? At least, you know, kind of focusing our attention on what's happening in the EU. If Google is kind of seen as guilty of this, this really imparts major change on how Google does business. What might that look like?
Well, the European Commission has made some recommendations yesterday when it announced its that it was charging Google with violating this, and it said that it might force that behavioural changes aren't going to make a difference to achieve real impact and to make things right. It's saying that Google is going to have to sell off part of its ads business, and also if it's found guilty, it's going to face some pretty big penalties too, financial ones.
What kind of penalties have they gotten into the details as far as what that actually looks like, or is this kind of like at a later date?
No, it will be, they could impose a fine of up to 10% of the company's annual worldwide turnover. So
wow,
pretty big numbers. Yes, pretty big numbers. I think 10% is big for any company. But when we're talking about Google, you know, Google's ad tech unit especially makes up 79% of total revenue last year. And I think it shares a quarter of the market share for global ad revenue too. So we're talking really big numbers.
Yeah, that's interesting when you put it in that perspective. It really reminds me, like, so often in the past I've gotten accustomed to big technology company, you did something wrong, we're going to punish you, and then the amount that comes out, it's like, are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, that's a large amount for me, random person, yeah, you know, yeah, walking on the street. But for a company like Google, like, that's a tiny, you know, drip of slobber coming out of the side of their mouth compared to, you know, everything else that they've got going on. It's a tiny fraction of what they even care about. So that seems to me to be an incredible incentive for Google to make these changes. I'm just so curious to know, like, how Google's search product, like, what we end as consumers end up seeing, and what the businesses behind the scenes ends up seeing. Is it just that Google will then be forced to not favor its own and really kind of liberate and open up and open this marketplace for everyone else to be involved, but not them, something along those lines?
I mean, it's hard to tell what action Google is going to take, but what we do know is that in 2017, they're accused of something quite similar by the EU again with regarding its Google Shopping products.
Mm-hmm. And that's right.
For that claim, it was given a $2.7 billion fine. So again, big numbers, and it dealt with the issue by separating its shopping service into its own company. So maybe it will take a similar approach with its ads company and run the two separately with its own separate revenues and profits.
Yeah, no question. Now, so obviously this is in the EU, and you've mentioned, like, there's similar things happening here in the US and in other places around the world, but there are always kind of these rollover impacts. If one region, especially of something this major, if one region of the world, you know, forces Google to make a change, there's got to be some trickle down as far as how that impacts their business in other parts of the world. What might that impact be for Google? Is this the kind of thing that the EU imparts this change and Google is then really kind of like, you know, it almost makes sense to do this on a wider basis so that we don't face this challenge in other markets? Or, hey, we're not there yet, so let's continue as business as usual in these other places and just give the EU what they want. Is that feasible?
I mean, if I were Google, I would be taking this seriously, especially with the potential fine that they could be facing. Because even though Google earns a lot of money, you know, when we're talking billion-dollar fines, you know, that's big even by Google standards.
Yes.
So, I don't know, sometimes prevention's better than cure. And mm-hmm. I would consider rolling this out globally, perhaps, to prevent hefty fines from all around the world. Because how many more times can it keep paying out billion-dollar fines?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. Is there any way that what we're seeing here in the EU, this focus on Google's ad business, might impact other businesses that have, you know, something going in the ad industry? I mean, we commonly talk about the ways in which the ad market can be just kind of it's a challenging landscape. Let's just put it that way. It's got a target on its back in a lot of different directions. This is just one example. How might this in the EU impact other businesses, not just Google, or if at all?
Well, I mean, if I was a company operating in a similar way, I'd be paying close attention right now, because if they're doing it to Google, they definitely do it to the other companies, and Google probably has more money to fight these cases than smaller companies perhaps. So I'd be paying close attention and also following what action Google takes up afterwards and perhaps adopting something similar. But one thing's for sure, I don't think, even with all of this going on. I don't think Google's going anywhere. It's still going to be the world leader in advertising, digital advertising.
Yeah, indeed. It'd take a lot to take Google down as far as that's concerned. I would absolutely agree with that. Well, really appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk to us about this. Nicola Agis writes for Search Engine Land, searchengineland.com. Love what you all are doing over there. If people want to follow you and your work online, of course, they can find you at searchengineland.com. Are you doing any socials? Where can people find you there?
LinkedIn would be a good one. I'm on LinkedIn and also on Twitter at Nicola_Agis.
Right on. Thank you, Nicola. It was a pleasure talking with you.
And you. Lovely to meet you.
All right. Nice to meet you too. We'll talk to you soon. All right. Coming up, Mac gaming, getting a major boost. Big deal. If you have a Mac and you want to be gaming, you're gonna be happy with this news. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Brooklinen. I'm so happy to provide my thoughts on Brooklinen because I've been sleeping really good lately. Brooklinen's mission is to provide you with hotel quality luxury bedding delivered directly to your door at a fair price. It was actually founded by husband and wife duo Rich and Vicky in 2014, and Brooklinen has everything you need to upgrade your home with quality products and curated designs that are going to leave your guests swooning. If you have that guest bedroom that someone's staying in, you throw some Brooklinen's sheets on there. I guarantee you, they're going to wake up the next morning and be like, so we got to talk. Brooklinen has been making dream spaces a reality for almost a decade, so they're the obvious choice when making your house a home. If you're unsure where to start, Brooklinen has these bundles that are going to help save time and money, whether you're outfitting a bedroom or a bathroom or both. Their best-selling luxe sateen sheets have a buttery soft feel, luxurious finish that is great for all types of sleepers. If you actually prefer a more natural option, Brooklinen's latest launch features an organic collection. You can actually go to brooklinen.com to learn more about all of their different styles of sheets. You can find your perfect match because everybody sleeps differently. You know, some people want a lighter sheet that breathes a little bit more. Some people want something a little bit warmer, a little heavier. Everybody sleeps differently, right? Brooklinen is the best gift for any picky parent. So you can spoil your dad this Father's Day. It's coming up. As a dad, I can say this would be a great gift with any of Brooklinen's collections. Wirecutter and Good Housekeeping both awarded Brooklinen for their outstanding bedding. They also have over 100,000 five-star customer reviews. So people are really loving what they get from Brooklinen, unsurprisingly. One reviewer said, I seem to get that wonderful sleeping temperature very quickly and stay there throughout the night versus with my older cotton sheet sets. Another said, best sheets in the world, like butter. And I just have to say, I ended up getting the Luxe Core sheet and ended up getting this really nice, like almost slate colored Oxford stripe duvet cover, which was perfect because we had this duvet cover for so long and we had been wanting to upgrade, and we upgraded to this thing. And I immediately feel like our bed is just like is upgraded like entirely. Like nice. It was just the sheets that are on top, but it makes the room feel more luxurious. It's wonderful. A full pillowcase set. We are loving our Brooklinen set. Brooklinen uses only the highest quality materials for all of their products, such as long staple cotton. So everything they built is built to last. You can check out their sheets, their pillows, towels, bath rugs, robes, even. I'm sure those are actually really comfortable, and so much more. So what are you waiting for? Shop in-store or online. Go to brooklinen.com to gift yourself or your loved ones the rest they deserve. Visit brooklinen.com today and you'll get $20 off. Plus, you'll also get free shipping on orders of more than $100 when you use the code TNW. That's brooklinen.com. And then use the code TNW. You'll get $20 off plus free shipping. I love Brooklinen. I'm a super huge fan. And you will be too. So check it out for yourself. Brooklinen.com, code TNW. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right. So, Micah, gaming on the Mac, what you got?
Yes. So, obviously, the big conversation at WWDC was Apple's new Vision Pro headset that will come out sometime next year, early next year. And the conversation mostly surrounded that. There was a little bit of talk about the Macs that Apple announced, and a little bit of talk about all of the operating systems that it updated. But one of the big highlights that came out, I think, after the show, and something that got a lot of attention, was the game porting toolkit. And what this does, sort of in its the planned use for this, is a way for game developers to be able to see what it would be like if their games ran on a Mac. So let me kind of break this down now, because for forever and always, it seems like there's been this sort of conversation about true gaming doesn't happen on the Mac, right? If you want to do your AAA gaming, you're going to need a PC and you're going to need to run Windows, most likely. Mm-hmm. Linux, not really. Everything else, not really. True gaming needs to happen on a Windows PC that's pretty souped up. And then the other games, of course, take place on consoles like Xbox and PlayStation. Well, Apple has always kind of tried to combat that. Of course, it's got this huge mobile gaming landscape and lots of people who play lots of mobile games. But to combat the idea that true gaming can't happen on the Mac, you always see Apple highlighting some sort of title, some gaming title that comes out. And so they will have these little demos, or they will show off little previews where people are doing some what looks like pretty powerful gaming on the platform. Yet the big game titles, the big game names, don't end up making their way to the Mac. A big reason is because game developers, game publishers are making games in such a way that they simply run very well on Windows machines. Mm. And then, of course, you have your console games that run very well on the consoles. But to then try to take some, to either hire a team or to try to internally use resources to also develop for the Mac, they don't have the resources to do that. So it doesn't get the attention that the rest of the games do. So I guess this is what's kind of confusing to me, is that I guess what Apple was hoping is if they can get the developer or the publisher to quite literally visualize what it's like to run a game on the Mac without doing anything to it, then they will be encouraged to make the game for the Mac first party situation where it's running natively on the Mac, because then you'll get even better performance. So it's supposed to be kind of like a bragging moment. Like, even though we're doing all of this work, it's still playing quite well. So obviously, if you could actually just make it for the platform, then it would be even better. What's happened, though, is tinkerers and developers and, you know, nerds and geeks everywhere have realized that they can use this toolkit to run these AAA games and many other games that only run on Windows on their Macs. So another change that Apple made at this WWDC is that it used to be, in order to publish apps on Apple's platform, in order to use the developer betas, in order to make use of all of the developer tools, you paid $99 a year. And so that $99 a year got you access to all of this stuff that you wouldn't have otherwise. Well, this year, Apple said, we're doing something different. All you need to have is an Apple ID that you log into the developer side of the account, and you can get access to pretty much everything save for the ability to publish apps to the App Store. That requires an actual $99 per year subscription. So now more people are able to you know, try out development, are able to run the developer betas, are able to test it, et cetera, et cetera. It's a great sort of democratizing of that portion of Apple's development stuff. But that also means that anyone can go and get this game porting toolkit, download it, and then there are a bunch of tutorials now and even some little sort of toolkits that let you install, for example, Steam for Windows on your Mac and then run DirectX 12 games on your Mac. Now, it's important to understand that it is not emulation. And this is where I'm actually, I want to be clear. I want to quote the inimitable Christina Warren, who is a GitHub employee, but has been a longtime guest on many shows here on the Twit Network. Very excited that I got, this morning I was looking through headlines and I saw, oh, Christina wrote something. So occasionally still publishing things, which is exciting. And she did a kind of a deep dive into this. And so one of the aspects that she talks about is that this is not emulation, but instead is translation. So what's happening here is that so a game developer is basically creating a game that your inputs call on different parts of the operating system, right? We just talked earlier about APIs. So it's the picking up the phone and being able to talk to the system and having the system talk back to you. So what would the way that it kind of traditionally works is that the system would call to the Windows platform, and then it would be translated so that it could call to the Linux platform or to macOS platform. And so Apple kind of took that and built upon this technology with this toolkit to make it possible. It kind of flattens that aspect of it, that translation or emulation aspect of it. So it's a little bit closer to the hardware, if you will. So you can get some pretty good performance. There are loads of videos out there now of different games being run. Diablo 4 is a very popular game right now. And so they showed that running close to 60 frames per second at 1080p, and then also running close to 90 frames per second at the default resolution on a MacBook Pro. So yeah, here we've got some video playing showing, and then the game porting toolkit has this little readout in the top right corner that shows how well the game is working. It shows the performance of the game. And again, the idea here is that a developer would look at this and go, holy moly, if it can run this game, if Apple's silicon is able to run this game at this level, without being directly made for the game, just think of how amazing it would be if it was made for this platform. It would run even better. It would run even smoother. It would maybe work on lower power chips. So someone could be running Diablo 4 on an M2 Apple Silicon chip on a 14-inch MacBook Air instead of needing to have the MacBook Pro. And then the idea is that it's going to open up that there are going to be so many more devices now that could be running these games. And that is, you know, supposed to kind of entice.
Right. Worth your time. Yeah, worth your effort.
Exactly. Worth your time. Worth your effort.
Yeah.
And, you know, Apple even talks about how this 14-inch MacBook Air I have here, this is just the standard M2 MacBook Air, is a great gaming machine on its own, but could be even better if, you know, there were more titles available for it. What's important to understand, though, and I think that it's something that has mostly been missed, I think even, in, or not I think, but including in this piece on Inverse, is that Apple's game porting toolkit is not the be-all, end-all solution. And in fact, Apple's licensing surrounding the game porting toolkit has, you know, terms that say, We're not providing this as a way for you to publish games and sell games on Apple's platforms. So the only way to make use of this tool is from tinkerers, is from the developers, is like I can install it and do all of this backstage stuff that I need to do and then run a game with all of the complication that's involved. But it's not as if
the everyday user is not going right. to go near that.
And, yeah. and not only that, but it's not as if Diablo 4's maker, whoever that is, I'm not up to snuff with all of that. But Diablo 4 couldn't tomorrow start offering Diablo 4 for macOS.
Right. Yeah.
Shipping that tool inside of the game. They would have to create a Mac version of this. This is just for these developers and publishers to see what it would be like to run on a Mac platform. Mm-hmm. So while people were really, really excited about this and thinking, oh my goodness, there are going to be DirectX 12 games on the Mac, you know, in the next 3 months. No, as the license is currently written and as things currently stand, that is not going to be the case. But I'm curious. I'm wondering if that might change because I was at the on Wednesday, this past Wednesday, I was in San Jose at an event called The Talk Show, which is John Gruber's show. It's a podcast, but every year at WWDC, he holds one in person and typically talks to Apple execs. And the guy in charge of marketing for Apple, Jaws, was there. And one of the things that he said was somebody had asked a question about this game porting toolkit. And he said, I heard that's really breaking the internet right now. So guy that's in charge of marketing for all of Apple knows that just having this game porting toolkit has quote unquote broken the internet. I wonder if we might not see a change where Apple gives these developers the ability to ship a version of this so that they could run games on the Mac without having to completely translate over for the Mac. And it's like, yes, you could make it directly for the Mac and it's going to do this, this, and this, and this. But why not make it, if I can already run these games, or in some cases, there are some games that won't run but just need a little bit of tweaking. Let's make it possible. Let's let these Macs be part of the you know, options for someone. Because, Leo had to, in order to play some of the games that he wanted to play, buy and outfit an entire Windows PC system just to be able to play those games. And not all of us can do that.
Man, but maybe that's been the way it's been for decades.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to have both. You'd have to run both platforms.
And, yeah.
That's just not the case for many people. So, While this is very exciting that it works, and while some of us are able to make this happen, A, it's not for everybody to do. You got to do a lot of terminal stuff. It only sometimes works when it does work. And it is not intended to be a way for developers to ship games tomorrow for the Mac.
But it proves something.
It proves something.
Yeah, it shows that it's possible. And I think I'm sure there are a lot of Mac users who, like myself over the years, have wondered, like, man, you know, this hardware is so amazing.
Yes.
It can do so much, and it's relied on in many industries that require, you know, things like graphical power. I mean, mm-hmm. all, you know, the graphic arts
music,
industry,
graphic
music,
arts.
Like all of these creative industries that require great hardware the underlying hardware in order to pull it off. It's doing all those things. Why is it not doing these things?
Yeah.
Like it's always baffled
and
my
I think
mind.
They wonder that sometimes internally
for
at
sure.
Apple, why developers have continued to not try to put resources into making it for the Mac. So I think they've just gotten to a point where they go, well, if they're not going to do it, then we're going to, it's almost like they're extending the bridge halfway and hoping that they'll extend the bridge the other halfway.
Yep.
As opposed to just waiting on their side going, come on, build that bridge. It's like,
right.
No, they're not doing that. All right.
We'll give you a little something.
Exactly.
This is pretty impressive.
Grab my hand.
That's pretty cool to see what they pulled off.
Yeah. Everybody go read that piece over on Inverse from Christina Warren. It's a great piece. And that's it looks awesome. At the history of Apple gaming too, which is a sad, sad, sad history.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Well, speaking of history, there are two in the story that I'm bringing to the story of the week.
there are two topics that I am a big fan of mm-hmm. converging into one. Whoa. So it was like when I read this, and then of course Leo talked about it a little bit on This Week in Google yesterday, but I was like, I gotta talk about this because like I love the Beatles, mm-hmm. and so often we're talking about AI here on this show, and this is like, you know, the peanut butter collide. And the chocolate coming together, yes. worlds collide. So to kind of give a little bit of background here, Paul McCartney was interviewed on BBC Radio's Radio 4's Today program just earlier this week, ended up making a bunch of headlines. He mentioned during the interview that he and the other surviving member of the Beatles, Ringo Starr, were working to release one final Beatles song sometime by the end of the year. That song, I've actually heard this song. Back in the day, I used to collect Beatles bootlegs, and this was definitely one of them. Is an old John Lennon demo called Now and Then. It's a great song. The recording is incredibly rough. It was basically recorded in 1978 on a boombox sitting in front of John Lennon while he was playing piano and really? Kind of performing and singing. So a single recording. It's not like a multi-track thing where any of that stuff is isolated. I'm going to get to why that's important. But super lo-fi, super noisy. There's actually like this electrical buzz, this underlying buzz underneath it as well. So I remember hearing the demo. God, a couple of decades ago, I got this bootleg, this John Lennon bootleg, and it was part of that. And loving the song, and I was like, that's a shame that there isn't a better version quality, better quality version of this. Back in 1995, if you remember, the three surviving Beatles at the time, that was McCartney, Starr, and George Harrison, who's no longer alive, teamed up with Jeff Lynne. They produced a creation of two new Beatles songs to coincide with the anthology release, which was essentially releasing all sorts of B-sides, unreleased material. Because, I mean, Beatles lore is just filled with, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of hours of these lost recordings and stuff that if you're a fan, if you're like a fan that obsesses over the Beatles, you could spend your entire life hunting these things right, down right. And people get really obsessive about it, you know, as far as that's concerned. Well, the two songs that they pulled out were Free as a Bird and Real Love, both taken from old John Lennon recordings. And at the time, this was like 1995, mm-hmm. they were able to take these old noisy recordings, clean them up, sync them, record multi-track, so you had all the remaining members of the Beatles kind of recording on top of it. They had their producer to kind of help them along, and those songs became real Beatles songs. I mean, it's probably, you know, Beatles fans probably are divided on whether they are constitute real yeah. Beatles songs.
Oh, that's its own thing, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. Wow. Or, oh, that was a John Lennon song, and then they did their parts over the top, and yes, it's all the same people, but it wasn't really created all four of them together, so is it the same thing? Anyways, the music...
The Beatles purists.
Yes, exactly, of which there are many. Don't get me wrong. So that came out with Anthology, and it was a big deal at the time. Two new Beatles songs that you've never heard before, you know?
Yeah, that'd be exciting.
And it was a big deal then. So, and actually, from a technological standpoint, like, especially through nowadays perspective and what I'm going to talk about next, really impressive that they were able to pull that off and clean up that old, you know, crusty audio with 1995 technology. This was before much of the audio industry was doing anything inside of computers, like as like the computer being the be all end all location of a lot of this, the way it is largely now. It was a lot of it was done with hardware, which, you know, the hardware was obviously good enough to pull this off then. Things are different now. But George Harrison at the time refused this as a third track. They wanted to do this track as a third release at the time, but okay. The audio was so bad.
He's like, no.
And they tried. They went into the studio. They spent an afternoon recording elements and everything like that. They ended up giving up on it. George Harrison like refused. He's like, nope, it's rubbish. The vocal quality is just horrible. Like, there's nothing we can do to make this sound good. But important to, you know, reiterate, they all kind of offered parts in the process before they were done. And that's important because George Harrison is no longer alive, but he did put down some guitars on this. A few years ago, you remember Peter Jackson had the Get Back documentary. Did you see that documentary?
I did not.
You got to be a real big Beatles fan to appreciate the documentary because it's incredibly long.
Yeah.
But I've like,
I heard loved you it. And Leo both talk a lot about it. So I know that it was for the folks who are, yeah, I'm sure it was amazing.
Yeah. It's just a really cool kind of insight into how a band of that, you know, that importance, I'd say, in the music world, how they worked. So it was really cool. Well, a big part of that was the use of artificial intelligence to go back to all of the tape that was recorded back then and remove other elements from the audio recordings to isolate the voices, because this is a movie, you know, this is essentially a documentary, a movie. They needed to be able to clue in on what that person's saying over there, what that person's saying. But when they recorded all this footage back then, they didn't do it with that in it necessarily in mind. There was a lot of other stuff getting in the way. Artificial intelligence, we can train it to say, I want to hear that voice and I don't want to hear everything else. And so that technology was really successful with how that turned out. They also use this technology in a, I didn't realize this, a reissue of the album Revolver, where that album, when it was created, everybody was around a single mic and they were all kind of performing or a mic setup. They were all performing. To go back and remix that at a later date was not easily done because they were all in the same room. They used artificial intelligence to pull out the individual pieces and do a remix a couple of years ago. So that's pretty interesting. All this is to say is where we're at now is Paul McCartney saying, we're going to release the third song. It's that song from then. They're using the technology, the AI technology that Peter Jackson used for the Get Back documentary to pull out and isolate these parts from this. And I say they're going to, that's not true. Apparently they've already done it. It's going to come out this year. And they were able to kind of isolate those vocals, clean them up, isolate the piano, take the George Harrison guitar that he recorded back then and bring that into the recording. Wow. So they will actually, even though they're doing this, you know, at a time when both John Lennon and George Harrison are no longer alive, they're able to put together the what McCartney says is the final new Beatles track.
So this is not typing out new lyrics and AI generating his voice to sing new. It's just for isolating.
It's taking what is, yes, to my understanding, that's exactly
okay. Because when I first heard about this and I didn't read
you were like,
it,
no.
I thought, oh no, they're gonna like make just like the, you know, the virtual versions of Tupac and all that weird stuff.
Totally.
In this case, yeah, adding to the song or something. But if it's just, I think that's a fantastic application of artificial intelligence, frankly.
Once again, it's kind of like the a comparison that I come up with is Photoshop has certain tools that for years, people who know Photoshop have been able to do things that people who don't know Photoshop wouldn't have the slightest clue how to pull that off. Mm-hmm. And now artificial intelligence makes some of those things so easy.
Yes.
Right. And is able to do these really kind of magical things that we didn't think you could do at a push of a button 10 years ago.
Oh my goodness.
And that's kind of where we're at with AI and audio right now is it's possible to go into these single recordings and analyze the audio. And even though it's all, you know, if it was multi-track, if I had the piano over here on one track of audio and the vocals over here, that's very easy to isolate, mix, and do different things with. But if it's all on a single recording, it's very difficult. And AI has made it a lot less painful and able for a band like the Beatles to do this. I don't know how it's going to turn out. I'm super curious how it turns out, of course, just because I am a Beatles fan and I love the process of it. Like I love knowing the lore and the story around this. Is this revisionist history though? Like, you know what I mean? Like it's taking two people who are dead. One of them who opposed to doing this 20 years ago or 25, 30, I don't know, almost 30 years ago.
See, to me, that's the one complication in this. I don't think none of the rest of that matters. I know purists would have a different perspective. But the idea that the person didn't want to do this, but they also, George didn't want to do it because of how it sounded at the time, right? It was like,
that's a really good point. Yeah.
I'm putting my name on this because it's rubbish. It's absolute rubbish. But
it's
if
rubbish.
They can make it, not sound like rubbish, then perhaps it would be something that he would be okay with at this point.
Yeah.
Because I go back and forth on, I recently did a rewatch of all of the Star Wars films, and I go back and forth on the choice that Lucas made to add in CG to some of the original films in places where it wasn't originally there. Mm-hmm. Because on one hand, you have the this is the creator. Like, this is the person who was at the you know, forefront of making this possible. And so
if anyone should be able to make that choice, it should be the creator of it.
I'd like to think that if I made something and I wanted to go back later and make adjustments to it, that I could do that. Mm-hmm. So ultimately that's kind of where I landed on that. But there were times where I thought I could understand how people might want to just see it in its original form
for sure
and see what it was like. And in fact, I did that with some of the scenes. I looked up, you know, what they originally looked like just to see the difference.
Yeah.
And sometimes it felt like it was egregious, but there was a purpose for all of that for George Lucas, which was to essentially move the technology forward by showing, it's a little bit like what we were talking about with the Game Porting Toolkit, showing others what could be done and getting them interested in it, which led to that shift into digital video. So it was more than just, I'm making a story here. And I think sometimes people don't like to realize that and hear that. They get a little closed-eared about how George Lucas, in, you know, from his mouth and from the mouth of the people around him, his point was to, like, just as much as telling a story, it was also, these are some examples of how we can use this technology. Everybody should be using this technology, and we're trying to push it through.
Right.
And so, you know, you've got to understand the intent of the thing. And yeah, for George, this George, who just at the time was going, well, no, we're not going to release this. This sounds terrible. This isn't a Beatles thing. This is rubbish. If it's not rubbish now, that's fantastic.
Yeah, there you go. I also think it's pretty cool that McCartney has seen everything that he's seen around music from back in the day, the birth of rock and roll being there at the very beginning, being such a monumental part of that history, all the way to now where AI can like go into those old recordings and give them new life and everything. And it's
what that must be like to witness.
Totally. I mean,
because honestly, it was just shocking to me to hear you say that they were releasing an anthology in 95.
Like,
they existed far enough before that they were doing an anthology in 95.
Yeah.
That's not even 2000. It's just wild.
I know. It is crazy. It is crazy. But anyways, these stories really, really get me, get my imagination going. So there you go. I love it. All right. We've reached the end of this episode of Tech News Weekly. Thank you so much for watching and listening. Thank you for subscribing, because that's the most important thing that you can do for any of our podcasts. Go to the show page of whatever show you love. But in this case, twit.tv/TNW. Click the button to subscribe in your podcatcher of choice, and you will never miss another episode again. Thank you for doing that.
Also, if you'd like to get all of our shows ad free, we've got a way for you to do that. It's joining Club Twit at twit.tv/clubtwit. When you join the club, starting at $7 a month or $84 a year, you're going to get a lot of stuff. As I mentioned, first and foremost, every single Twit show with no ads, because you, in effect, are sponsoring the shows. So it's a great way to get all of the content. You also will get access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else. Behind the scenes, before the show, after the show, special Club Twit events all get published there, and access to the members only Discord server, a fun place to go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members and also those of us here at Twit. Again, it starts at $7 a month, $84 a year. And it's not a scale thing. It's not like if you pay $10, then you get a call from Micah Sargent, or if you pay $25, then you get a Twit license. No, it's $7 a month. We just provide people the ability to pay more if they'd like to, because we heard from some folks who said, you keep adding stuff to the club, I'd like to give you more. So you put in $7, you put in $8, you put in $9, whatever you'd like, but starts at $7 a month, $84 a year. And along with that, you're going to get some more amazing stuff. It's special shows that exist only in the club. There's the Untitled Linux Show, which, as you might imagine, is a show all about Linux. You also can watch Hands on Windows, the short format show from Paul Thurrott, where he covers Windows tips and tricks. So all of you Windows users out there can make sure you're making the best of those machines you have. I do a show in the club called Hands on Mac, which covers all sorts of Apple stuff. stuff. Although right now I'm going through macOS Ventura with window management. So everything you need to know about making sure you've got your windows organized and all laid out exactly as you want them. And the newly relaunched Home Theater Geeks from Scott Wilkinson is also in the club. So please consider joining the club, getting all of those great shows at twit.tv/clubtwit. Why?
There you go.
It suddenly went away from me for some reason.
Yes. That can't possibly be right, yeah.
Except it is. twit.tv/clubtwit. If you would like to follow me online, I'm at Micah Sargent on many a social media network, or you can head to chihuahua.coffee, chihuahua.coffee. That's where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. Consider subscribing to my shows on Tuesday. You can tune in to watch iOS Today with Rosemary Orchard and Yours Truly, where we cover everything to do with Apple's sort of mobile platforms, iOS, watchOS, iPadOS, etc. On Thursdays, of course, here on Tech News Weekly, as well as Hands on Mac, if you're a Club Twit member. And on Sundays, where I co-host Ask the Tech Guys with Leo Laporte, where we take your questions live on air and answer them. Jason Howell, what about you?
Oh, yeah. At Jason Howell on Twitter, twit.social/@Jason Howell on Mastodon, other places too. I'd give you my Reddit username, but Reddit's kind of a mess right now too. So anywho, All About Android every Tuesday, twit.tv/AAA. Don't miss it. Having a lot of fun there. Got a review of a phone that I'm not talking about quite yet coming up on Tuesday's episode. So twit.tv/AAA for that. And just a big thanks to everyone who helps us do this show each and every week. John, Ashley, John Slanina, who's actually not here today, but Burke, McQuinn, everyone behind the scenes, marketing, everybody that helps us do this show and spread it far and wide. Thank you. And thanks to you for listening, for watching, and for subscribing. We appreciate you. We'll see you next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here. In case you hadn't heard, Home Theater Geeks is back. Each week, I bring you the latest audio-video news, tips and tricks to get the most out of your AV system, product reviews, and more. You can enjoy Home Theater Geeks only if you're a member of Club Twit, which costs $7 a month. Or you can subscribe to Home Theater Geeks by itself for only $2.99 a month. I hope you'll join me for a weekly dose of Home Theater Geekitude.